The point about national narratives is exactly that they provide a protocol for thinking. They don't just tell a story, but they say, this is what you must not say, this is what you must not think. And quite a lot, I would have said, of writing that we value does precisely the opposite to that, that it refuses that national protocol that says, don't speak like that or don't say things like that.
Welcome to the Heist Podcast. I'm Ben Schumann-Stoller. Today's episode is a conversation between Heist founding editor Peter Matthews and Nobel laureate Abdulrazak Gurnah. It's a conversation we recorded when Gurnah was in town for the International Literature Festival in Berlin, or the ILB. You can find the interview also on heistberlin.com, and I'll make sure to link to it in the show notes. Remember, you can also support us from as little as 9 euros a month, and that really goes a long way toward extending our cash runway and helps us continue running as a worker-owned, independent resource for Berlin. Now, to set a bit more context about the interview and Gurnah, Abdulrazak Gurnah was born in Zanzibar, part of Tanzania. In 2021, he received the Nobel Prize for Literature. The Swedish Academy said he was awarded for his, quote, uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fate of the refugee. You'll hear some talk in this episode about ancestral human remains and museums, which was the topic of a BBC radio documentary that Peter and I made last year, but also a lot more. Like, Peter and Gurnah talk about the case of Bayoum Mohammed Hussein, who served in the Schutztruppe, the German colonial army, before he came to Berlin, where he worked as an actor and appeared in Nazi-era films. Eventually, he was arrested by the Gestapo and died in Sachsenhausen concentration camp in 1944. His is a story that Gurnah uses in the character of Ilyas in his novel Afterlives. The conversation begins right away with the concept of cosmopolitanism. It's an important idea for Gurnah, because for him, it doesn't just mean like worldliness or looking out at the world from some center or a European capital. Instead, Gurnah thinks about many centers, like the Indian Ocean, Central Asia, the Middle East, and how each of these centers has been a place of exchange, of transmission, and encounter for just as long as Europe has. He said the difficulty of seeing this isn't just an intellectual failure, but a kind of historical blindness that we all still live with in the West. So that's the question that Peter starts out with. Here's Peter and Abdulrazak Gurnah.
You write about finding shards of pottery in Zanzibar from China. And I think that one of the ways that your work, it sort of re-centers, it's a way of looking at Europe from a distant place, which sort of re-centers our relationship. And I wonder if you think that sometimes cities like Berlin can be sort of blinded by their sense of being in the center, that they don't sort of see themselves as one node in a network, but that they have a sort of myopia of the center.
Well, you could put it like that, although that sounds like you're picking a fight with Berlin, which is not necessarily, it continues. Speaking like that continues the sense of that the normative is the big European cities, or the normative is an idea of the world which kind of pulses from Europe to the periphery. And of course, in terms of power or in terms of prosperity, that is probably largely true, and at least until recently. Now we have China, of course, as another center of precisely that, both in terms of political interest as well as in terms of its capacity to finance, as it were, its activities in the world. But there's another way of looking at this, which does not necessarily mean that you have to talk in terms of periphery and center at all, but to understand the idea of what I suppose you would call cosmopolitan. Now, the more familiar, the Western explanation for what that means is for, shall we say, people in the West taking an interest in other parts of the world, and therefore they become more worldly. So cosmopolitan, the world city, as it were. What that assumes is that there is indeed a center. There is a place where the core of human culture and civilization kind of emanates into the wider world. Whereas perhaps it's more correct, I think, in experience, to understand that there are several cosmopolitanisms, several centers of exchange, transmission, historical and contemporary relationships. You might say, for example, the Middle East is one of those, where different cultures, different religions, different ethnicities have been, well, bickering a little bit, but also living together for a long time. Or you could think of the Chinese cosmopolitanism, or the Central Asian, or indeed the Indian Ocean. These are places that have their own sense of who they are, in a sense, and it's one that goes back a long way and still is still sustaining itself, is still going on. It doesn't mean that it rules out the possibility of engaging with other ways of being or other centers of knowledge or whatever. But it doesn't mean that it's, you know, kind of completely deferential towards a more superior epistemology or more superior culture or something like that. It's very difficult to step out of that if you're used to thinking of both historically and culturally, you're thinking of yourself in that way. And I think this is the kind of bind, I suppose, that a lot of Europe is still in how it regards itself and how it regards the world. And of course, not just Europe, but North America as well. North America is more complicated because it already has entangled within it other cultures and ethnicities and histories, and which is constantly, it seems to me, wanting to resist, wanting to say, as we're seeing right now, no, like the United States is a white nation. Well, it's not. It's more than 50% not white. But, you know, that insistence is part of a desire to return to a more stable idea of who we are.
I think that that idea of picking a fight, which I'm not trying to do, but I think that idea
of...
I know what you mean. I think that your work, it does have a sort of matter-of-fact sort of relationship with the world. I wonder if that's something that has changed for you in your life. Did you always have a sense of being part of a center, I suppose?
No, that would be to put it too strong, because that would be a kind of self-awareness which is not available to, let's say, a teenager or even perhaps a young person. It may be something that comes with a greater understanding of where you are in the world. See, most of the time people don't think about these things in the sense that, you know, they're not self-consciously saying, where is my center? Who am I? And that kind of thing. People don't do that. They've got more immediate anxieties, like, you know, whatever it might be, bills and, you know, crying children or something like that. But it is something that when you begin to reflect about it, then you do ask yourself questions like that. But I think that comes later. That comes out of, I suppose, studying or scholarship or thinking, just generally being interested in those issues. And or maybe reading brings that about, that as you read about other places, and if you read with enough care and penetration, then it might mean that you might say, how do I relate to this, especially if it's in some ways about me or something to do with me. But for myself, I suppose I was, like a lot of people, I would say from the part of the world I come from, happily unaware that somebody thought that I was on the periphery of anything. I thought I was where I was, you know. And I suppose it's just, and this would happen to most people traveling from their origins, I think. It's maybe that is something that accelerates or exacerbates that sense of self-inquiry about yourself, about those questions of how do I relate to this place? Who am I? How do I relate to where I come from, indeed? But maybe those are not questions that arise if you're kind of where you are, feet on the ground, stably getting on, and the things you'll be worrying about will be your career or your schooling or something like that. But I expect that for people who are estranged, I mean strangers, I don't mean estranged in the sense of alienated, but people who are estranged, it is a question that you have to kind of come to terms with.
To return to the city, there are things in Berlin, in the museums here, for example, sort of taken from Tanzania or these places as part of the kind of this historical legacy. One famous one is the giant Brachiosaurus dinosaur in the Natural History Museum here. I wonder whether these transported objects, the physical objects that surround, that are taken from former colonies, do they give you a complicated or different sense of being in a city?
Not me, because I don't, not, it's not you're asking whether I feel that sense, no. Because where they are, in which part of the Germany, say, or Britain or whatever, isn't that important. The fact that they are in the Humboldt here, or the fact that they're in the British Museum, isn't the most crucial thing. The most crucial thing is first the impulse that made this transaction happen. And you're talking about the dinosaur. I would have thought the most sensationally outrageous items that were brought back were human remains. And not always for ostensibly scientific reasons either. I mean, that was the ostensible reason to study these, whatever. But quite often there were trophies of war. For example, the leader of the Hehe people in Deutsch Ostafrika.
You write about Makwawa.
Makwawa, indeed, who was who gave the Schutztruppe a great deal of trouble. But when they finally defeated them and captured him, they cut his head off and brought it back to... I mean, this is not to do with science. This is to do with a kind of vengeance. And there are many other trophies like that, not only in Ostafrika. You mentioned the others, but the others are not that many, so it's worth knowing them. And that is what is now Namibia, Cameroon, and Togo in relation to Africa. These are the places. And other atrocities of equally outrageous nature happened in those places as well. And the remains were brought back here. So I'm saying it's the impulse, really, that is the one that engages, it concerns me or makes an impact on me, rather than where have they put them.
Mm-hmm. Those human remains are still held here to this day, I mean, in museum basements or whatever. I think Freud uses burial artifacts as a metaphor for repression in some way. I think he writes about how things which are buried underground and not exposed are then preserved unchanged. And I wonder whether you think that Europe does have somewhat of a repressed attitude to its colonial history.
Oh, definitely. But I don't think it's those remains that are indicative of it. But they would, I suppose, would quite like to bury them now. But they're there, they're in display. If you go to the Humboldt, they're stacks, and you can observe them. It's not that they're hidden anywhere.
I think the human remains are often no longer on display. There's plenty of trophies, I think you could call them in some way, but from all different expeditions. But I think they have made a decision on the whole to put the remains in the basement, has its own complications, I think.
But it's a practice that perhaps is kind of being modified, but and it's not only the colonial practice towards Africa, but I remember visiting the Natural History Museum library. It's a library, really, but it's also a museum of the University of Oklahoma, and there are stacks with human remains of Native American people who were displaced from there. And they are, you know, dated. And there are these boxes. I suspect they too are in a basement now. Because of what that indicates, it seems to me, is a kind of not just recognition, but shame at this knowledge that this is what we've done. And it isn't something that can be explained away. What is interesting is the reluctance to release them.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something else I wanted to ask you about, which is in Afterlives, you rework some real historical personages. I'm thinking particularly of Bayume Mohamed Hussein, a Tanzanian who fought on behalf of Germany, worked in Berlin, not too far from here, actually, taught English. He acted in Nazi propaganda films and finally became a victim of the regime. I wonder if you could tell me what drew you to this story in particular.
It was the particular story was a chance. The idea of people who became mercenaries for the colonial armies, not just in this war, but also for the British, for the Portuguese, for the Belgians, and so on. It was that interested me. One of the questions that I was interested in answering, or at least investigating in Afterlives, is how did people who did that explain it to themselves? What did they think they were doing? What would make somebody become a mercenary of a force that is going to be oppressing your own people, if you like? And one of the things I came to understand is that they were not their own people. They did not think of them as their own people. The idea of an African was not one that was there at the time. People thought of themselves differently, in more precise or in more, local sort of senses, even if they were big local, but nonetheless. So that's what I was interested in. And then as I was doing my reading and, you know, I ran across this, in a little footnote, a reference to this person who became an actor. This was the first thing that I saw, who was a Schutztruppe and then became an actor. And so I started looking into that and read a little bit more and then found out that there was, in fact, a very interesting history. The other interesting thing to say about that figure is that he was not Tanzanian or Tanganyikan, or those words, in fact, didn't exist at the time. He was actually Sudanese. And this is the connection between the Schutztruppe, the Sudanese, the British, etc. So they first become mercenaries. These are Nubian people who become mercenaries of the British against the Mahdi in the late 19th century. They're demobbed in Alexandria. Colonel Wissmann is looking for mercenaries. He goes to Alexandria, recruits them, and takes them to Deutsche Ostafrika. So they're there as a foreign army, in a sense. And he's one of those, or he's a descendant of one of those. So that complicates it. It's not just simply a Tanzanian, which, as I say, didn't exist anyway, but he was not even part of the place. He's part of something completely different. And you might think of that he's kind of revivified by his connection with Germany. It's the Germans who give him a life, pick him out of some misery in Alexandria, make him a sergeant or something like that. I think he was some kind of NCO. And he's German in his heart, as it were. They are his saviors.
That's right. And did you feel...
And then they kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the story of him here in Germany is quite remarkable, and you deal with it very condensedly. I like that little coda in your book at the end where someone comes and finds out the story, and you follow them, actually not in Berlin, they're in Bonn, and then they go. And but his story was, I think, he was a waiter not too far from here at this big sort of amusement nightclub sort of thing, and starred in these Volksschauen, these sort of shows they would do to sort of show off people from different parts of the world. I wonder how much did you then follow up on that? Obviously, you adapted it for your story was different. You were taking a different...
Well, I didn't want to write a story that was sort of like historical. I wanted a figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made him a musician. But the picture that I describe, which is the picture that the young Ilias, as the budding journalist, as it were, which he does as his project for the course that he's doing, that is a picture of Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
There is actually a picture. The description is a picture of Hussein standing on stage with the big swastika flag behind him, and a man in a lederhosen, a young man in a lederhosen, standing on one side, and another man with an armband and a brown uniform, the brown shirt uniform, on the other side, obviously doing some kind of song. It was that I thought, okay, I will make him a singer rather than an actor. But I did see in my various researches as well, I did see Ivor Knopf's film, where in it, I don't know if you know it.
I know it. I haven't seen it, but I know of it.
But what she does is she actually shows various clips of the films that he took part in.
Mm-hmm.
And in most of them, or almost all of them, he's either a waiter or he's wearing a Schutztrooper uniform.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there. You know, you see him. He has parts, as it were. He's an actor. But then it doesn't completely work out like that.
Yeah, he was in, I think, the big film, one of his big films was, final films, was this film about Carl Peters, this who came and he plays the assistant in Germany, in the north of Germany, or in Wedding, in the North District. There was formerly a Peters Allee, a street which commemorated Carl Peters, which is now, had the name changed to Maggi Maggi Allee.
Oh, dear.
And there's also a Stolperstein. Are you familiar with these?
The pavement things.
The pavement things, exactly, commemorating Hussein as well.
Okay.
Elsewhere in the city. I wonder if you think, you know, Germany's had an interesting relationship with its own memory. How does it commemorate its own past? And I wonder whether you think, if you reflect on that, I mean, in that colonialism has been often considered a bit of a blind spot in how Germany reflects on its own past, because, you know, it gets sort of eclipsed by the story of the Holocaust.
Of course.
Do you see those things in relationship to each other, or do you think is there something that we can learn from or complicate about the idea of memory culture?
In relation to how colonialism is remembered in Germany, it seems to me understandable that it would recede a little bit in memory, because there are these events in the 1930s onwards, or at least the next 10 years from the 1930s, that quite rightly occupy the minds and the anxieties and indeed the memory of people in Germany and related nearby. So, and also Germany ceased to be an imperial nation in 1918. What it didn't cease, and this is what is forgotten, is that the reclaiming of the colonies was part of the Nazi platform. So it would have been something that was kept alive and bubbling by that desire. Now, the connection that's made, particularly by Hannah Arendt, but others, is that the earliest lessons for the Nazis and that indeed for the Soviet Union as well, arise out of the experience of colonizing and subjecting others, in the sense of, in the case of the Soviet Union, it was mostly adjacent cultures in Central Asia, say, that kind of thing. Whereas for Germany, very late in the day, the British and the French and the Portuguese and the Spaniards have been doing it for centuries before Germany joined that overseas business, going to Africa, going to Australia, and so on. So that seems like a long way away when compared to the events of the 1930s and the 1940s for Germany. So when I say it's understandable, I'm not saying it's okay not to remember colonialism, but you can see why the foreground of memory and indeed of inquiry becomes that. And that other thing, oh, cool, we can't deal with that as well, you know, when we're dealing with this. But sure, the time has come now where, you know, people are coming around to understanding this. You can't make the same excuse for the French and the British, though. They don't have this big guilt to sort out as a result of the Second World War. But they're just as happy to suppress the memory of, or at least to retell the experience of colonialism in ways that suit them. I mean, no more about the British experience and the French experience, but I think there are probably similarities in the way that the presence of, say, Algerians in France is seen as an intrusion, even worse than that, perhaps something like a danger. And there is a There's a famous remark, and it's contested who made it first, but which is that we are here because you are there. And so the Algerians are there because the French were there in Algeria. And the same also is true of the consequences of colonialism for European societies, is that you were there. And that's only one, of course. The other reason is more to do with prosperity or perhaps for, you know, safety for refugees and so on. But that's one of the reasons. But that's a longer way of coming round the issue that you're raising, which is why do they not remember?
Mm-hmm.
They don't remember first because they have other things to worry about in some cases. And the other more obvious thing is the way that national memories work is to suppress shameful events and always, you know, foreground the aggrandizing, self-aggrandizing events.
I mean, I think that your work, because it comes from such particular stories and doesn't, it seems to work against that idea of national memory in some way, in that the stories are complicated and particular, and that we follow a single story through a life. And it seems in some way to work against that idea of, I don't know, grand narrative. Would that be too much?
No, that wouldn't be too much. Of course, if you use grand narrative, you immediately start thinking of postmodernism. But I don't operate in that sort of refusal of a kind of core values or something like that. But the point about national narratives is exactly that they provide a protocol for thinking. They don't just tell a story, but they say, this is what you must not say. This is what you must not think. And quite a lot, I would have said, of writing that we value does precisely the opposite to that, that it refuses that national protocol that says, don't speak like that or don't say things like that. And sometimes we confuse this with the idea of narrative perspective. Sometimes people say, people go away in order to be able to write about whatever. Well, it's not just distance that does this. But going away means it's a way of also refusing the kind of everyday sense of being oppressed by what can and what cannot be said. That was your last question.
I think that was the last question, yeah. So
I like this when you do interviews, because I got one more question.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can see them taking a breath to ask another one.
we'll spare you that. So thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Heist Podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, check out the other episodes on the podcast feed, and please leave us a review or a comment. It tells the algorithm that we do indeed have fans and listeners, and then in turn helps us to reach others. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the next episode. Till then, bye.